Hey guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm going to be your host for this episode. My name is Kevin Estella. I'm recording this one here in North Carolina. I've got a good buddy in front of me, and it's actually really exciting because I normally only get to podcast over the phone, but in this case, my guest lives locally and he wanted to come down. So I'm going to dedicate this podcast, it's something that I normally don't do, to the memory of two officers and in honor of another officer from my hometown. Now, 2 days from now, we're going to celebrate the 1 year or remember the 1 year anniversary of a fatal thing that happened in my hometown where Lieutenant Dustin DeMonte and Sergeant Alex Hamsey were murdered by an absolute piece of garbage. And it was the heroic actions of Officer Alec Irado, who saved many lives that night. So I'm dedicating this podcast to the memory of Lieutenant DeMonte and Sergeant Hamsey, and in honor of Alex Irado. So good job to all of the Bristol PD that are hanging in there. And it's very fitting that my guest today is, you know, coinciding with that dedication, because he spent many years as law enforcement. He has a very extensive background in defensive driving and executive protection and you name it, all sorts of good stuff. And we're going to talk about mobility today. We're going to talk about driving. We're going to talk about all sorts of wild stuff. Like, I wish I was recording our just kind of banter back and forth before I hit the record button on this podcast, because there's some good stuff, but I have a funny feeling there's going to be more. So with me today in the studio, again, very rare in the studio, is my buddy from Griffin Group, Mr. David Blaylock.
Hi, sir. Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Honored to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad that you're here. Like I said, it's rare that we get to do this. And you're a natural storyteller. So I have a funny feeling that this is going to be one of those podcasts that people are going to rewind certain parts and be like, did I just hear that?
Right.
Holy crap. So just so you guys know, I met David when we first did a breakout class here in North Carolina. Now, breakout is a 5-day scenario-based training event where we subject the students to a lot of different stuff. We're teaching them med survival. We're teaching them personal security. We are introducing them to automatic firearms. And then there's the driving portion, which I'm going to say selfishly, that is the most fun portion as like a role player, as an instructor, is when we get to train along with the students in the scenario. And it's like, we try to hide our excitement, but all I got to say is, and you've probably heard me tell this story before. The last time I was with David, he goes, yeah, we're going to use these Crown Vics over here or whatever the vehicles were. He goes, but if any of you want to use that all-wheel drive police charger over there, and before the students could turn around and run to the charger, I'm running over there with Jerry and with, you know, Doc Jones, and we are laughing like kids, like, this thing is badass.
Yeah.
So that's how I know David, and I wanted to bring him down here because he's just a wealth of information. So take us from the beginning.
Yeah. So, again, thanks for having me. So I'm honored to, I love working with Fieldcraft. I love what you guys do, especially with the civilians. So, I'll just kind of start from the beginning. So I'm from North Carolina, born and raised. My father was a state trooper in North Carolina. He started in 1965. So it's all I ever was around is law enforcement and predominantly state highway patrol from North Carolina. So, I knew at a pretty early age that I was going to be a cop. I just wanted to be him. He was my hero. And so, you know, everybody else is kind of watching Batman and Robin. And so my heroes were those state troopers that, and he had such good relationships with them. So he was a line sergeant when I was born and made it to the rank of captain over the years. So I knew, like I say, early on, outside of that dream that I had of being in the NFL, which, you know, that's all I cared about was football, and wasn't a great student. I just is before, you know, they started diagnosing kids with attention deficit and all that stuff. I just couldn't concentrate because I was typically scribbling either a police car or a football helmet or something. And so I just knew I was going to be a cop from as long as I can remember. So we moved around quite a bit because the way the Highway Patrol works in North Carolina, at least the way it used to work, is when you were promoted, you were moving. It wasn't a matter of staying in the community. So I went to 4 different high schools. So I was always the new kid.
You never got into fights, right?
I got into fights all the time. And it was always, I used to think you're tough because your dad's a state trooper or whatever. And it's just, yeah. So I was in quite a bit of that. Plus, I was kind of, you know, a knucklehead as a kid. you know, and so, and I think back, I've even seen some of my teachers over the years that taught me. And much like some of the people I would arrest later that I was friends with in school, and they would say to me, wait a minute, you're a cop? Like, mm-hmm. I remember one guy I had handcuffed, and he looks at me and says, David. I was like, and I looked back at him, I said, wait a minute. I said his name, and he said, you became a cop of all people? I said, I know, it's as crazy to me as it is to you. So I was kind of a rambunctious kid. But anyway, when I got closer to 21, I really wanted to do it. My father, to his credit, never pushed me mm-hmm. in that direction. I think in hindsight, in fact, I was like, why didn't he? I feel like he's not supporting me. Afterwards, he told me, well, I just didn't want to feel pressured, like a lot of your listeners and viewers.
Were you ever a police officer when he was a police officer? Or were
yes.
you serving at the same time?
Yeah. In fact, we worked on the same agency, because after he retired, he actually ran for sheriff. And I ultimately wound up working for him, which is a whole other story we'll get into yeah. about nepotism okay. and that sort of thing. And, oh, you just got it because you're the sheriff's son. And I actually left and went to another agency because of that, because I didn't want it to look like that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I went through basic, and it was hard, you know, just like any basic for military or law enforcement, the running and all that and being yelled at. And because I was a bigger guy and because everybody, it was a small community, people knew my dad. So they were really vetting me to say, is this, you really want to do this, or is it because your dad? I remember they would nickname me Trooper, and it wasn't in a good way. And like anytime we would do hands-on or anything, I would always be the guy. Like, get over here, Blaylock. And so I remember getting pulled out of a window and slammed on the concrete, and we were doing some riot control class. I don't even remember the name of the class. And I got knocked out from the instructor. And so anyway, I went through all that, the tasing and the pepper spray and the CS gas and all that. And I guess my dad was like, well, he must be committed to this. Mm-hmm. And so then I got in law enforcement, started at a very small agency. And I, even in law enforcement, even in the academy, I remember thinking, this just feels like a hurdle to in order to get through this, over this hurdle, to get out in law enforcement, that's when you start learning. And only now, after, you know, everything else I've done, we need to start there. We're not training correctly. I remember firearms. I think we might shoot, you know, I don't remember what we shot in basic, but I know a qual, you might shoot 100 rounds. That's it.
Yeah.
And so we're shooting at the 3, the 5, the 7. We're changing magazines altogether in sort of an admin way. At no point in firearms and basic was I under any stress.
Yeah. We've had a lot of people say over the years, they're like, man, the firearm standard is so difficult.
It's so
and
bad.
I'm like, hold on. The standard?
Oh, yeah.
Like, some of those standards, you just have to hit the paper.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. You only
like,
had to shoot for, and some agencies are different, but I think our pass was 75.
Wow.
Even as a young guy, I'm thinking, well, that means that's a lot of misses. That's a lot of misses. And is that going to be someone else that's not involved in it? So I just remember going through training and thinking, this doesn't feel right. We spent very little time on the range, very little time in the driving course. And now we're driving every day. I was driving 12 hours a day. It was not uncommon for me to drive 350 miles in a shift. And I would do that 4 times a night, because there's not many of us, and we had a pretty large area to cover. So we were constantly driving.
What was the average response time for a call?
It could be, let's say if I'm on the other side of the county, there's maybe 3 of us, 4 of us working. It could easily be, even going wide open blue light and siren, it could be 10, 15 minutes. And you know, things are typically over by then. So it's, we were driving a lot of time with not a lot of training, not a lot of formal training,
mm-hmm.
post 100 miles an hour, blue light and siren. And, you know, you start looking through those McDonald's straws, especially in chases. And in the 90s, I mean, we were chasing people. It was crazy. I mean, we were pitting people, and it was just crazy back in the 90s. Lucky lived through it. In fact, I don't remember what year it was, but I got hit head on. And we were just driving to a store. I remember we had left some kind of community activity, and we were just literally going to get some coffee, me mm-hmm. and another officer. And we're driving down the road. I think I was going maybe 40 some miles an hour, and I got hit head on. And it was a fatality in the other car. The passenger died. And
what did they do? Cross the yellow line?
They ran a stoplight. They ran a stop sign. It's actually on video. And my car had a camera. And then there was a camera that was on a church. Because the family fought it. It was pretty cut and dry. They ran a stop sign, but I think they just weren't. And it'll kind of get into one of the main reasons I start teaching driving. It was actually two soldiers, reserve soldiers, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And I think what played into that was it was a dark street and the kid just wasn't familiar with where he was. The driver lived. But I remember I didn't see it coming. Like the way the intersection was, and I just remember driving and we were talking. Next thing I know, I just remember him yelling my name. And the next thing I know, the car exploded, essentially. And I remember, you know how things slow down. Mm-hmm. That's a real thing, because yeah. I remember as we got hit, and I'm basically spinning like at a 180 away from the collision, the whole front end, it impacted, airbag hit me. We came to rest. I remember that might have taken 2 seconds, but I just remember all the thoughts that were through my head. Well, this is how I die. I'm dying right here in North Carolina in this little dark street in a car wreck.
You probably have that flashbulb memory too, where you can probably recall where certain settings were on the radio, things were in the ashtray, ashtray.
100%. The smells, airbag smells. In fact, I was listening to somebody, I think it was an interview that, I think it was Tom Satterley. He was talking about the smell of burnt hair. And as soon as he says it, I smell it. You know, just those smells, but the airbag smell. And working where I work now, we encounter a lot of airbags. So I'll smell it, and it takes me back to the wreck. But I remember getting out, and I'm thinking, well, I know I'm banged up. I start feeling my legs. I'm expecting bones to be sticking out, and everything was fine. I was able to walk. My partner, he had gotten the breath knocked out of him, but he's fine. I remember getting out and walking over to the other vehicle, and just to check on them. And the driver was kind of, you know, shaking the cobwebs off, but he looked fine. And the passenger's just sitting there still with his eyes open.
Oh, geez.
And he had died on impact. And he's the, and obviously, I mean, statistics will prove that seatbelts save lives, but he's the only one that did not have it on. Is that why? I don't know. I know the Highway Patrol did a reconstruction of it because it was a long process. People were coming after me. I mean, they thought that I was in the wrong. Mm-hmm. So it was a long process. That was hard because the family, understandably so. I think they might have thought it was some conspiracy between. And trust me, the DA's office is in no way going to help us. I mean, right. they're going to just do what they're supposed to do. So they did a thorough investigation. But that was hard for me because I remember laying in the ambulance. And because the EMS came and I was fine, but obviously EMS got to do their job. And so they laid me down on the backboard. And I remember thinking, man, this is tough. I'm processing, right? The adrenaline's out. And now I'm coming down.
What year was this in your career?
This was
like early in the career?
No. This was late, actually. Okay. This was like, in fact, I was driving a Charger, one of the Dodge Chargers, which I'm glad I was, because the way that car was set up, I would have, you know, I'm a fan of the Charger.
Yeah.
You should see the picture of the car. And in fact, I'll show you the picture of the car. You would have thought there's no way anybody lived through this, and certainly would have lost their legs. Didn't have a scratch. But I got out and EMS starts showing up and they lay me on the backboard. And I remember just getting in the ambulance and it was rough. I remember looking at the ceiling of the ambulance and thinking, man, somebody died. Mm-hmm. And then you start thinking, did I do something wrong? Because, I mean, you're adrenaline saturated.
Right.
And you're like, did I do something wrong? I don't think I was speeding. We were literally just driving down the street. And they had uniforms on.
Yeah, take your time, man. I'll tell you, you know, it's
so it
says something about your character, though. Yeah. I mean, like, because there would probably be people that would say, well, I can't believe those guys hit me right away, you know? And I guarantee that that's a response that's common. Yeah. And I guarantee other people would say like, oh crap, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
But like the fact that your response was something bad happened to people, and to have the awareness that they had uniforms on, and it wasn't like they were dregs of society.
No,
they were
right.
serving this
right.
country,
right.
you know? But and, at that time, like they, you know, we always say like, you always have a vote, you know, and it's sad to say, but the guy who didn't put a seatbelt on, he voted.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
right. And it's, you know, and so, yeah, went over there, and because I've always especially respected military, I was like, man, this is at my hands, somehow at my hands. Obviously, you know, it was ruled that I was not at fault. There's video of it that proves it, but that doesn't make it any easier to live with. It's like, what could I have done different? Like, I'm sure everybody goes through that. especially in traumatic things like military and law enforcement sees, EMS see it, even dispatchers, they go through traumatic events. And so you're thinking, what could I have done differently? But I just remember the ambulance ride, because they were going to fly in somebody. Now I'm starting to think the word had already gotten out that I was dead. You know, so now I'm freaking out about my family and my father going to hear this because, you know, small communities, word travels fast. And so I'm thinking, man, this is, and this kid died. And all I can see, and to this day, I still see that kid like I saw it yesterday. Like it's mm-hmm. just ingrained, it's snapshotted into my memory. So that was tough. But then that inspired me to really start the driving training, just because I didn't see it until it had already happened, just the way the intersection was and that sort of thing. But I just, you can't help but think, what could I have done different?
It seems like, you know, you're saying that event inspired you to action, but was there ever a point where you had hesitation to get back behind the wheel?
No. And that's, and I'm fortunate for that. I will say this, like I'm probably most comfortable behind the wheel. Especially when you start going fast. In fact, I was in a big town this week, and it's almost like I'm desensitized to it because I'm driving in Chicago traffic and it's already chaos. And I remember it was a guy in the car with me, and somebody starts kind of easing over into my lane, and he's like over there hitting he's on the passenger side. He's over there hitting his brakes, and I'm like, wait. And I'm like, I'm good. I've done it so much that immediately I do the math. I know I still got like 2 or 3 feet before this is even a concern. I never had any hesitation about that. It was, in fact, I don't think I missed any work. I didn't want to. People were like, hey, the sheriff, to his credit, was like, take some time. Mm-hmm. But I felt like the best thing to do is just get right back to it. I felt like if I go and take time off, then it's really going to get in my head.
Yeah.
I just want to get back to work. It didn't really affect me like that. I mean, it still affects me, but not that way. I was able to just get right back in it and drive. Because we drive for a living. We're, mm-hmm. like I said, we're spending so much time behind the wheel. The vehicle's our office. It was my entire, I don't think I ever had an office. It was always my car. I don't think that ever affected me. And until you asked me, I don't think I ever even thought about that.
Well,
I mean, sorry. I'm sure that whenever I started, I got a spare car and that was a brand new car. One funny story though about that is because it's a small community and I was pretty aggressive as a drug officer. We were in sort of a bad area when it happened. And I just remember when the car came to rest, one little, you know, lighter side of it is EMS is treating me and I'm just letting them do what they do, you know. And one of the guys, a fireman I know, is who's now the fire chief, but at the time he responded. And I remember him taking the shears out. You know, they want to cut your pants off. It's cold. And he's like, I see the shears. I'm in the neck brace. And I'm looking at him. I'm like, do not cut my pants off in front of all. Because, I mean, the crowd, everybody came out of their homes.
Right, right.
And so this is like a crowd around us. And I'm just on this backboard with a neck brace on. I see these shears. I said, do not cut my pants off. But it's funny because the yard I landed in, the yard where the car came to rest, a guy came out that I had arrested many times. And obviously he comes out and the way the cars, when we hit, we turned like 180.
Okay.
So we rested in both cars rested in the opposite directions of the original, the way we were traveling. So anyway, it looked to him like I ran a stop sign. Like I was coming from that way because my car got spun around. So he comes out and I just remember him saying, Blaylock, you ran that stop sign. You ran a stop sign. And I just remember laying there listening to this guy. And I told the fire chief, I was just joking. I said, just do me a favor. Just hand me my pistol for 1 second. And but anyway, he laughed. And I remember one of my partners, a detective, showed up. And he was ensuring me, hey, I'll call your family and I'll call your dad. Let them know. Because they knew the word was probably out that I got hurt. Because the rumors now was that I died in the wreck. So I could thankfully, the word got back to my father and to my family that I was actually okay. But someone did die in it, but it mm-hmm. wasn't me. And that person got airlifted out. So you know how the rumors swirl.
Well, you know, that's a common phenomenon right now, even on Facebook and social media. Like I'm a member of like the Talk of Moore County or whatever that mm-hmm. is on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Utah, when I was living out there, I belonged to like the Provo Canyon Watch.
Yeah.
Which, you know, there's accidents left and right in Provo Canyon. I drove that strip for 2 years and I can't even tell you how many cars I saw that were wrecked. But people would say, There was a motorcycle wreck. And then next, you know, the line of questions would be, what color was the motorcycle? Mm-hmm. Did the guy survive? Because now people are saying, well, my husband goes on mm-hmm. that road, or my daughter goes on that road. Yeah. And yeah, the rumors can take over so quickly. Yeah. And then sometimes it's something like where it's like they're doing like a hypothermia training in the lake, and there's fire trucks everywhere. And then next thing you know, people will say, well, there's a car that went in the lake. It's like, no, that was staged.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah, 100%. Like it's, I guess, you know, a lot of my friends are, I'm on social media, and a lot of my friends are ride bikes, and they'll say, hey, check in, because mm-hmm. something will have happened. And they're checking in because they know the rumors are going to swirl. Yeah. In fact, that's why I don't have a motorcycle, because I know. I've just seen too many motorcycle wrecks, and I know how I would probably drive a motorcycle. So I never bought one, as much as I'd like to have one, but I've just investigated too many wrecks through, or mostly, I would say 90% of the time, not the motorcyclist's fault.
Right.
It's other people.
Right. I mean, it's scary enough. Like when you, like I do a lot of running on the road and, mm-hmm. and rucking on the road, and I always walk into traffic mm-hmm. because I want to see the eyes of the driver.
Right.
And I can't tell you how many times where like there's a section where it goes from sidewalk to just asphalt and the side, you know, with the grass, and I have to run on the asphalt mm-hmm. and I look over and there are people that are clearly on their phone. And what do they say? Like if you're looking at your phone to your right, you swerve to the right.
Yeah, absolutely. Wherever your eyes go. Your eyes go. In fact, that's one thing we talk about is the phones and stow all that stuff, especially some of the military clients that we have. They understand it already. They just don't get a chance to practice it like we do. But look at wherever your eyes go, especially with motorcyclists. I think one of the things they tell them is if you look at something, you're going to hit it. But that it's not just for motorcycles. That's for any vehicle you're driving. But it's like it's happening. It's with the cell phones and all these things out there and the mapping that's in the cars. It's like we're having more and more wrecks just through sheer inattention, not looking through the windshield.
Yeah. Jerry Young, who you've met, you know, Jerry, mm-hmm. he has a dedicated GPS up on his dashboard. Mm-hmm. And he said, I have it up there because I had one in my cruiser. Yeah. And he's like, it's less tempting to grab my phone.
Yeah.
And like, I think about all the crap I've got on my phone that can distract me. And whether it's like Onyx if I'm hunting, or it's the flight radar if I'm waiting for someone's mm-hmm. flight or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like there's so many different apps that are out there that could just draw your attention away from
I'm guilty of it too. I can't help but every once in a while, if my phone, you know, especially if I'm in bigger towns, I just try to stow it, and I'll even try to put the voice on there that I won't have to look.
Right.
It'd be prompted by the lady's voice. So I won't have to look, because I've seen too many wrecks, you know, and I'm not trying to be like, you know, the overprotective person. I've just seen them. I've investigated a lot of fatalities, and a lot of it is just sheer inattentiveness. They were just looking at something else. Yeah. It happens to law enforcement. One of the biggest reasons law enforcement are getting hurt in wrecks is the computers, the mobile data terminals they're putting in our car. A good friend of mine, I thought he was dead. I got to him first, and his car, I don't know how many times he flipped. And that car was just, by the time the car stopped flipping, it was just a big ball of metal. And I flashed my light down in there, and he opened his eyes, and he just covered in blood. And he said later on he was typing. In fact, he was typing something on his computer because he was responding to a wreck. So he was answering the communication center, going into a curve at pretty high rate of speed that I don't think he was very familiar with. And that almost killed him. He was lucky to just come out with some broken bones.
Damn.
So I'm just terrified when it comes to that. Yeah. You know, when we were driving fast all the time, I'm lucky that unfortunately it was a bad one, but that's really the only wreck I ever had.
Wow.
Was that one.
Well,
like I said, just normal day driving. It wasn't even like a pursuit or any of that stuff. It was literally just driving to get coffee and got hit head on, by a couple of kids. It's just scary.
That wreck happens. You make your way back to the, to the cruiser. You mm-hmm. get back on the road.
Yeah.
How long is it before you eventually say, "I'm done with putting on the badge and working as a professional driver"?
You know, it's hard because somebody asked me that question the other day. I told her I was going to do this podcast, and she said, "Well, why did you get out of law enforcement?" And whenever she asked me that, I'm like, "I was burnt out." She said, "Okay. But why did you get out of law enforcement?" And so it's hard to answer. You know, I do know the answer, but it was hard because, like I say, that's all I'd ever known. I knew I was going to be a cop. I loved it. In fact, and this is true, people might not believe it, but I think I know for the first year I was a cop, I didn't even know what I made money wise. Didn't care. Like I knew I wasn't making a lot of money, and we were obviously like a lot of cops working side jobs. I didn't even know what I made. Didn't care. I remember thinking one day driving down the street, I can still remember where I was thinking, if I won the lottery tomorrow, I would still come back to work the day after. Because I love this job. It's the best job in the world. I remember somebody saying it best. He was like, this is a front row seat to the craziest show on earth. Like, you know, literally one minute you're, you know, at a domestic, you're being a marriage counselor. And then the next hour you're at a fatality where, and then at the next you're breaking up a fight, or you're doing a traffic stop and you're seizing dope, or you're arresting people for narcotics.
You ever have to deliver a baby?
No, I never did. You know, I know that's the story. I got a couple buddies that did. Luckily for me, I didn't, because I don't know how I'd handle that. That would be
I'll tell you, a good friend of mine, Detective John Brown, I'm going to say his name because I'm going to call him out. So he had to deliver a baby, and he's like, everyone says that, you know, baby deliveries are so beautiful. Yeah. Oh, it's a newborn. Oh, he goes, they're beautiful until you're in the batter's box and that thing's coming at you. He's like, he goes, I had to get my uniform clean. Like,
oh yeah. They showed us a video of it in basic. I remember it because I had a buddy. He's over in Fayetteville now. He's pretty high ranked. He's a big guy. And I remember, you know, he's a pretty tough guy. And I remember where he was leaning back in his chair. We were watching this video, and you know, I don't get sick easily. But this is just a unedited video of what the reality of it is. And obviously they were trying to prepare us for, hey, this is what it really is like. And I just remember him falling backwards and fainting in there. And I was like, I don't care about running in the buildings first, doing drug raids and all that. I just don't want to have to deliver a baby. I'll do it. But luckily I never had to. And it's weird because I was out in my entire career. I was on the road. I was never in an office purposely. I wanted to be out there. That's what I got into it for. You know, people will say, you know, why'd you get law enforcement? And you'll hear guys say the textbook answer, well, you know, protect the community and all that's true. But honestly, when I was like, I want to chase bad guys and put them in jail, bad guys. I want to chase them. That's just fun to me. And so I was out there my entire career, and I was stopping a lot of vehicles, because later in my career, I really switched to drug interdiction. And that was for me the only thing I really wanted to do in law enforcement, and quite by mistake that I fall into that. I pulled over a guy one day and I ultimately seized 6 pounds of marijuana, which now, like back in the 90s, around 2000, that was a big deal. Now, you know, marijuana, I mean, I have my feelings on marijuana, whether it should be legal or illegal. But at the time, it was a pretty big deal.
Right.
And I just remember thinking, man, this is the biggest bust ever. I'm going to be in the newspaper and all that. And, little did I know that wasn't even a drop of what is going through our highways and our community. So that kind of spurred me into wanting to do more of that. So I started going to schools, and like a lot of cops, I spent my own money to go to these advanced schools. Like, I would have absolutely paid money to go to a field craft class of what you guys are doing. And so I'm glad that you guys are doing a lot of work free for law enforcement, because they need it. I can tell you that they don't get it. And that's one of the biggest gripes I have about law enforcement, is we're literally training them incorrectly and then setting them out into the world and just hoping that they make the right decision. And they're uneducated on it. So it's almost like, you know, you see not to get on a soapbox, but, you know, you see these incidences with all the body cam footage. You see, if you get on YouTube right now, and people send them to me all the time, I literally saw a video the other day where It was in an emergency room. It appeared to be in an emergency room. It's a couple of cops. Ultimately, the guy, I spent a lot of time in an emergency room. We're in there all the time, especially with like mental patients or whatever. We're in the emergency room almost half of our career. And I just saw an officer have to use his weapon. The guy, I think it looked like he had wrestled one of the guy's weapons away. He was on the floor. You remember? Have you seen
it? I think you're talking about, he takes him down and then he stands up and then he takes him down again. And the officer has like a real terrible draw, and he presents the pistol at the guy. And then out of nowhere, the other cop comes in.
Right.
But the interesting part was the initial officer that was taken down twice and had the gun out. The suspect took him down again when the gun was out. Yeah. And I was like,
and did you see his malfunction?
No, I didn't see that.
So, and it could be another one, because I know there's a couple of them, but I'll have to share it with you.
Yeah.
It was disturbing because you could, and I get it. Look, I've been there. We've all been in stressful situations, which I think is what I'm trying to circle back to, is if we don't train them, get their adrenaline up, put them in scenarios to see how they do under stress. Because I'm sure that that officer knows he's efficient with his firearm.
Yeah.
But it looked like a malfunction, and just how much he struggled with that malfunction. That was a very easy, and I'm Monday morning quarterbacking it. I get it, but I have been there. So, but just how long it took him to reload it and get that weapon back up, because he's super focused on the problem and he had not done enough reps that it's, you know, that subconscious competence. I know what it feels like to reload the weapon and get back in here, and I can still concentrate on this big problem. And I promise you, I don't know this officer. I don't even know what town it was, but it's because he never trained that way. So even watching some of you guys do the training on the ranges, I'm like, that's more realistic than anything I got in 6 months of the academy.
Yeah, I think what needs to happen, and again, this is coming from a complete outsider. I never was military law enforcement, but I'm in the training space, and I would say, you know, the basic law enforcement training gets you through the door, but then you have to have the continued training.
Right.
And I look at someone like, again, another cop I'll call out, Kenny Stretz, right? Kenny Stretz is a good dude, runs Stretz Tactical. I was a student in his shotgun course, good friend. He's finally, you know, getting into jujitsu, and he's crushing it.
Yeah.
And he's like, I love this stuff. And not only is that, he's a good shooter.
Yeah.
So I think you almost need to have like the driving instruction, grappling instruction, continued marksmanship with the pistol, where it's beyond the basic standard. It's now a high standard, like high score, high standard, high stakes. And then on top of that, I think there needs to be some type of training for de-escalation.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think some people see like, I've got my gun, I got my taser. Yeah. It's like, well, can you go hands on? And before you go hands on, can you talk someone down?
Right.
You know, and
which is an art.
It'll do. Oh, definitely.
It's and I don't honestly, you know, it's funny you say that, because I'm really a big, I'm a huge advocate for de-escalating. And so when we set some of these scenarios, I'll tell them, I said, this doesn't have to be a shooting incident. Just because you have safety gear on, you have a SIM gun in your hand, do not read into that. If you say the right things and you de-escalate this, it doesn't have to be. And that's, I found, harder for people than I thought. Because I think what I was most proud of in my entire time in law enforcement was being able to talk to people. And I mean, from everybody, from the governor to the people on the street that we were, you know, looking for, and everyone in between. And if you could do that, that makes your job so much easier. But I've seen it over the years where people would show up, and hey, was I guilty of it? Probably. Whenever I started, I thought I was 9 feet tall and bulletproof. I was in my uniform, and I was a big guy. I was, you know, pretty healthy and not looking for trouble, but I definitely wasn't going to shy away from it. And I remember an old salty training officer of mine said, if you look for it, you're going to find it.
Yeah.
And eventually every cop's going to run across that person that's going to change them. And I did. I still remember his name. I won't say it, but it's funny because I came to be friends with him, not friends with him, but I would say acquaintances, but he almost killed me one night. It was to the point where we were fighting. And I remember thinking all the things that are going through my mind, like I'm going to have to shoot him.
Yeah.
And my arms are already rubber, and I was in shape and I was working out and still in my 20s or probably early 30s, but I was in shape. But this guy was just like a fire plug. I mean, he was just like, once I grabbed him, I'm like, oh, this is going to go badly. For me. And so, you know, after a couple of minutes, my arms are just gassed. And I could only get one handcuff on him. And I remember pulling out my Glock and was like, I'm just going to have to shoot him, because if I don't, he's going to take this gun and shoot me with it. And I'm in the middle of an apartment complex and people are just outside watching us. This was a Sunday afternoon. And I remember thinking, man, I've had a long weekend. Friday and Saturday, we were pretty busy. I just want this Sunday to go easy. Let me listen to the football game and work. And next thing you know, I'm literally in a fight in a ditch for my life. But all the thoughts that go through your mind when that's going on, it's like, man, I remember thinking, I'm going to have to push him off enough that the slide can slide back. Because if not, the slide won't reciprocate. And all these things that are going through my mind. And then I'm thinking, if I shoot him, I'm going to go through an investigation. And so I got to make sure not to shoot him in the back. And this is all while I'm fighting.
Yeah,
I remember, luckily, I was able We had fought over the pepper spray. I'm just, you know, like most officers will identify with this, you get the worst end of it every time you spray somebody. A lot of officers don't even want to carry that stuff, because especially if it's windy or something. So, yeah, we were both drenched in pepper spray. And I just remember people yelling. I don't remember what they were yelling. So luckily, I start hearing sirens coming. I'm like, if I can just hold on to him for another minute or two and not shoot him, it's probably turn out all right. So, but I remember thinking, man, you know, they train us on everything, but what we need the most, and that's grappling, fight, our jujitsu. Like if I would make it mandatory, because I didn't shoot anybody. Luckily, I never had to shoot anybody in my entire career. But was I fighting people? Oh yeah. Almost every weekend. I remember one of the worst fights ever was 4 o'clock in the morning at a huddle house. It was just chaos, you know, and, because I was bigger and in shape, a lot of times I would come out on top of it. But had I been comfortable with something like jujitsu or grappling, it probably wouldn't have even escalated to that start with,
right.
You know? And so I'm a huge proponent of that. I think that, these academies, and they're better, because I travel a lot over the country and I was talking to some Chicago PD guys last week. They said, oh yeah, we get a lot of that.
You know, I think there's a few problems with, like, we know that there's a training gap. We know that these cops need more training. Number one, the politicians aren't helping with this defund the police bullshit. Like that's just nonsense. Like, you know, and then we see what happened in New York with that kid who was an anti-police antagonist. And the next, you know, he gets stabbed.
Yeah.
Right. Like, guess what? You know, that's karma.
Right.
The second thing is there are a lot of cops that will say, unless I'm getting paid to train, I'm not training, and they don't see the value of it. And I get it. That exists in a lot of different careers where people say, wait, I have to come in on my day off to get trained. But what is the value of your life if you are grappling with someone who's about to take it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you have to see it that way.
Yeah. And unlike jujitsu, there's no timeouts.
No.
Like, it's his life or death. And, you know, I know that sounds dramatic, but trust me, when I was in that ditch, like a lot of cops, I mean, cops all over the world, much less the country, but I'm certainly not the only one that's ever experienced. But I remember thinking, oh, there's no referee here. There's no whistle. This is whoever gets this pistol is going to win this.
And it's
life or death.
And that's the other issue with this ongoing training is that we have to differentiate at some point what is sport grappling and jujitsu versus what's combat or practical for the officer. Because in a jujitsu match, I mean, if you take a wrist lock, you take a wrist lock. Well, you know, if you pull a heel hook on someone, you pull a heel hook. If you get someone in a chokehold, well, hold on.
Right.
Wait, cops and chokeholds?
Right. I mean,
what is it? Lateral vascular restraint? Right. You know, you have to be very careful, because what if you learn from a jiu-jitsu guy who says, like, I'm going to show you a choke. Well, hold on. I can't do that.
Yeah.
But if your life is on the line, I think that old expression, you know, it's better to be tried by 12 than cured by six. You know?
Exactly.
I would rather someone use a technique that's called a choke and walk out than not use it. And now we have to explain to the family.
Yeah. You know? And, you know, you talk about defund the police, and, you know, when all of that started, so I started my career just, I remember while I was in basic, the O.J. Simpson trial was going on. So we would watch it. And then I remember I was a cop. By the time the verdict came out, I was actually a cop. And I remember the verdict, which I obviously, like most of us, did not agree with. I remember going, I was working night shift. I got up, saw the verdict, drove to the gas pumps. And I still remember it. I remember putting gas in the car to go work my shift, and thinking, I have no confidence in the justice system. The justice system just proved to me that it's failed. How can, with all that evidence and all that, but you know what, but that didn't stop me from going to work. And just like most of us, like, I'm going to go out there with my fellow officers and we're still going to fight the fight. That's beyond our control. But then, you know, and before that, the Rodney King thing happened. I still remember that. And all my friends knew I was going to be a cop. And so it was pretty heated even back then. So a lot of people say it's never been like this. It has, probably not to this extent, but it's always been controversial. And so I remember thinking, that's not going to stop me from doing my job. But the defund the police, whenever I hear that, I'm thinking, because I know, especially agencies that don't have a lot of money, which is the case for most agencies, especially small agencies. They just don't have the money. They'll tell you, we want to come. We want to do your training. We just don't have the funds. So, but when I hear defund the police, I'm thinking, well, what you're doing is you're taking away the funds for the first thing that they need, which is additional training. Because if we don't have money, we can't go to any training. And I'm like, that's exactly what they need. So luckily, and you know, I know the phrase, because I've even heard you talk about it, the pendulum. And I agree with you. I don't think it's ever going to get back. I heard you say that in one of your other podcasts, and I agree with you. I don't think it'll ever get back. But I think that people are at least starting to see having some reason about this. Like, because cops are just mass exodus. I talked to a cop the other day, and I said, how long you got before you retire? He said, man, 8 years, and I'm out. I'm like, 8 years?
Yeah.
And you're counting the days at 8 years. I said, that's a problem, because that's a long time with somebody that's just appears to be miserable in their job, because and that's why I made a choice to get out. You know, so whenever I was asked the question, why'd you get out? It wasn't defund the police. It wasn't any of that. It was literally as uninteresting as it was. It was just I had 4 days off, and I got bored. I don't like sitting around. So Griffin Group is a company that near the airbase that trains a lot of military. And I just literally picked up the phone and called them. And I said, hey, is there anything I can do? I literally would have gone out and picked up brass.
Yeah.
Like, just been a range officer. I don't care. Just for something to do to in some way give back to the military. And at the time, that boss gave me another job to do based on my law enforcement. We had started doing some surveillance things. So one thing sort of led to another. I started doing more with military. And because of my background again, I started interacting more with students and then giving them some guidance on some things that we were doing. And I loved it. I was like, man, you know, I really like this. And it's noble work, but it's also like, man, not only can I just help this community, my own community, but I can help soldiers that are going all over the world. And that was like, oh, that's a light bulb moment for me. I was like, I definitely want to do that. And I want to do it more. And it started to be more fun than law enforcement.
Yeah.
And because of the environment. And I thought, and I still think, that I did everything I want to do in law enforcement. The drug, the getting large amounts of dope and seizures was like, for me, it was a chess game. Because, you know, we would sit out on the road. I might sit there for 4 hours and not do anything. And just watching cars go by, and I'm looking for indicators. And we'd pull them over, and it's like the chess match of, I need to get in this car, and I've never had anybody not give me consent to search. And it's all videoed, so it's like not, you know, because obviously this is going to wind up sometimes, most times, in federal court. So you got to have your, you know, I's dotted and T's crossed. So I was very proud that I always built good cases, because I knew eventually somebody's going to be looking. I always looked at it like the court's watching right now. So I enjoyed that. But then I did that and I felt like, well, I think I've done everything I want to do in law enforcement. And if it starts to get to the point where I don't want to go to work, that's bad for me. It's bad for the community. It's definitely bad for the officers, because that's contagious, right? It's like a cancer. If you show up with a bad attitude, it's just a cancer.
Right.
And I started feeling that way. And I really started enjoying the training space. And I thought, well, I can do a lot of good things over there too, that's going to reach these soldiers that are going, and largely special operations, men and women. I was like, man, this is a no-brainer. This is really fun. I like doing this. And so I did sort of a burn the ships thing. I literally gave up my certification for law enforcement. So I was like, I just don't want to be tempted to go back. So literally let my law enforcement certification expire. And they called me many times. They said, hey, you're coming up on 2 weeks, or you're coming up on a week, and now you got 24 hours. Are you sure you want it? Because who does that? You know, nobody gives up certification. Even if you're out, I know a lot of guys that keep it because they might do some work on the side or something that they need. And I didn't want to be tempted. And it wasn't anything about law enforcement. In fact, you know, I'm with what we're doing, I'm sure we'll talk about with this other thing. It's like, no, I'm most interested in helping law enforcement because I know where the gaps are. I've seen them. So I got out, but I feel like I can do more to help the community. And with this company, TOA, that we'll talk about, that I'm a part of, and luckily enough to be a part of, because the founder and I both see the gaps because we've both been in law enforcement. I just felt like I could do it on a bigger scale.
So before we get to that company, You know, clearly there are going to be people that are mm-hmm. listening from the civilian perspective mm-hmm. and from the law enforcement perspective. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would be a disservice to the listeners not to talk about some of just the lessons from training, yeah. right? Because there are some great takeaways. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, my background with driving, 1998, I went to the Land Rover driving mm-hmm. school at the Equinox Hotel. 2013, I went to Academy, yeah, which yeah. former Blackwater, mm-hmm. and I took the Advanced Highway Driving,
which I hear is a great course.
It's freaking amazing.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
So I went to that, and then obviously whatever you yeah. taught us in the mm-hmm. in those blocks of instruction. Mm-hmm. And some of my key takeaways: number one, a vehicle can accelerate, it can brake, it can turn, mm-hmm. and it doesn't do any one of those well when it's trying to do another.
Right.
Another one is make sure that you are seated properly in the vehicle. Mm-hmm. Push off of that head wall mm-hmm. and get two hands on that wheel right. and don't put too much input into the right. steering wheel. Right. right. One of my favorite takeaways from you, and I hopefully you can explain this more, is don't look at the speedometer, listen to the car. Yeah. And I've never heard anyone say that before, but when you did that, you're like, just listen to it. It'll let you know when it's yeah. gripping. It'll let you know when it's not gripping. Mm-hmm. And that was eye opening.
Yeah.
And then at one point you're like, okay, we're going to drive this track, you're going to go here. And we drove the track, I think, mm-hmm. very slowly at first. Mm-hmm. But then by the very end, we're like, I don't even know what these cones mean anymore. And we were right. just like, let's yeah. just see what right. this thing can do. But there were so many great takeaways. And I think one of the lessons that has stuck with me all these years is that, much like going back to the police, mm-hmm. once they go through the academy once, they may never see great training again or something that's relevant, some type of training, the same way that a person who goes through driver's ed mm-hmm. usually won't take another driving class for the rest yeah. of their life.
Yeah.
Like that blows my right. mind that
yeah.
there's no continuing ed for drivers. Yeah.
It's funny you say that, because I remember, and I ask the students a lot of times, you know, the first thing I'll do, and I have these guys that come in, and men and women from the military, but a lot of them are special operations, especially, you know, SF guys, super competitive. I mean, we've had everybody from like SEALs to MARSOC to SF to some of the other units, very competitive, mm-hmm. which I love, because it's like, okay, that's, I can work with that, because they're professionals. You know, some of the time I remember, and this is some of the old staff before the new owner bought the place, I disagreed with some of the way they trained. I think it was just for ease of the support guys, and they didn't want to get in trouble by somebody potentially wrecking or flipping over. Yeah. But I'm like, but what we're doing is a disservice to that soldier, because he is going to, or she is going to drive with their hair on fire if they're being shot at or they're being chased overseas. So we're going to train that way. So we're going to push this vehicle. We're going to find out where the limitations of themselves are and where the limitations of the vehicle. Because if I don't do that, I mean, my kid could go out there and drive around all day for and just not hit cones. I need to progressively step it up to where you find the edge. This is the edge, because an edge in a Pajero or a Delica is very different from the edge of a Crown Vic or a Charger. Mm-hmm. So we're putting them in all these different platforms. And I'll tell the students, I'm like, I want you to get comfortable with the course, learn the fundamentals, but then I need you to push it. It's just like, well, there's a lot of analogies to shooting, right? It's like, great, your target, your grouping's great,
yeah.
but go faster. And so only until I push it to failure. And that's the way I look at the cones. It's like, you're going to hit cones. I just want you to know why you hit it, and let's fix it on the next one. But I want you to continue to go fast every time until you find that limit. And honestly, the way they used to do it wasn't meeting that. And I would even hear SF guys, particularly, it was one class where the guy came up to me, and I was an AI. I wasn't a primary instructor. I was an assistant instructor. So it was kind of one of those things where I didn't want to step on the primary instructor's toes. But the guy came to me because he had seen me drive, and he's like, look, I'm not hitting cones. And the guy, he was making tire noise. And he was like, but I'm not hitting cones. And I said, hey, I got it. Like, I'm just not I'm the assistant here. But I get it. But I was hearing their frustration. And so luckily, Sheffield Ford came in and bought the company. And Sheffield Ford came from Special Operations, 7th Group guy. And he came in and bought the company, and he made changes in the instructors. And he agreed with me. He's mm-hmm. like, no, because he had been through a great career and a lot of training. So he knows the difference of reckless and actually training guys. So luckily, then those other instructors moved on and we were able to take over. So, yeah, but back to your point about the vehicle, it's like we were driving so much. And my driver's ed consisted of this. It was 1 week. I took it in Fayetteville, and I took it at a private driving academy. So it was like literally 1 week. I don't remember anything other than the instructor that I had was also a football coach. And I played football on the other team. And literally, the day one, he comes in and he says, this side of the class is going to drive. This is day one, hour one. This side of the class, pointing right at me, you're going to drive. And this side of the class is going to be in the classroom. And then after lunch, we're going to swap. And he's pointing right at me. And I'm terrified. I'm like, Now I'm going to drive in Fayetteville during lunch hour traffic. And this car, this is back in 1987. So the car is like big Delta 88, like Army tank. And I'm white knuckling this thing. And all we're talking about down Bragg Boulevard is football. And fast forward 5 days later, I get a driver's license and don't remember anything about drivers, learning anything. So whenever these, and that's stateside.
Yeah.
You know, that's, I think I always tell the story to the students too. It's like the most intoxicated person I ever arrested was at 9:30 in the morning. He blew like a 38. And I'm like, you know, a lot of times you think it's at night and you think it's, you know, in back country roads and that sort of thing. But if people only knew how many people were driving and passing them, I think I heard somebody say it best one time. The only thing separating you from them is a little strip of yellow paint or white paint. So it's a big trust thing when cars are driving by you that they're number one, not intoxicated, that they're number two, not in their phone. Mm-hmm. And just think about how many hours you spend a week driving. And if I don't know the statistics, but I know they're, especially in the area that I lived in, it's a large number of people that shouldn't even be out there driving with
right.
you. And
right.
that's stateside. So for our soldiers, they're in these countries that probably nobody has a license, no formal training at all. Nobody's paying attention to the traffic laws.
Yeah, roads are not maintained.
Yeah. In fact, for our soldiers, a lot of times if they're obeying the traffic laws, they stand out. So they, you know, they have to drive with the flow or they're going to stand out, which is the last thing these guys want to do.
Have you driven in Utah?
I have. In fact, recently I was driving in, we were in Park City and Salt Lake City recently.
The most aggressive drivers I've ever seen. And
I agree.
And people are going to be like, oh, no, New York is worse. I grew up in Connecticut.
Yeah.
I've driven in Florida. Yeah. I've driven in California. Yeah. I've driven in England. I've driven all over parts of the world. Mm-hmm. Freaking scariest drivers I've ever seen.
Oh, gosh. Utah. I saw an 18-wheeler flip over a jackknife. Was it 10 between Park City and Salt Lake City? Is that I-10?
There's,
is that really windy four-lane up the mountain?
Yeah. So there's 40 out there. Then there's 15.
15.
15 okay. is, yeah.
You know, my heart rate never really goes up driving except for that road. It's funny you say that because I remember we're going down this hill. And one time I was driving a Sprinter van. Like one of those big Mercedes Sprinter vans. And this thing is not exactly made for. And I just remember cars are going by me like NASCAR. And I was, you know, I was a little nervous. But you're right. I've driven in New York, too. Nothing compares to Utah. It's funny you say that because I think I made that statement to the person that was with the car. I was like, I've never seen anybody driving this crazy out here.
And here's the best part. Yeah. All those bad drivers are every single age. Like,
oh, yeah.
You'll be like, who is this asshole behind me? Like, you're expecting some, like, young punk.
Yeah.
And it's a like the soccer mom in her 50s, and you're like, she drives like that?
Yeah.
All right. So back to getting a little bit more serious about this. So you become the driving instructor, and you've got all these different people who haven't been trained, and they're operating in different locations. But what were some of those lessons that you would say, like, here's my top five things, like, you need to know how to do this as like a baseline skill set if you don't know them already?
I would say being able to drive the car at speed, especially for military, and definitely for law enforcement. We had some federal folks come through, and they bring their vehicles, which I love because it's like, I can put you in a Crown Vic. I can put you in one of our Chargers, but you're driving a truck that's loaded down with gear. It's going to handle completely differently. The fundamentals are the same, but I need to change it based on what I'm driving. So being able to drive that car at speed, the fundamentals of, you know, and I'm not as long as you got two hands on the wheel, like I'm the worst. And I tell the students, like, I'm the worst about 10 and two because I had a very bad habit over the years. It's just not even a training scar. It's just, I don't know if it was out of laziness or whatever, but a lot of times if we're in pursuits, we have our hand on the radio calling up, you know, making a left on the street, making a right on the street. So we're having to call it up every time, especially in pursuits, especially in cities, because it's every 2 seconds you're on a different road, so you're having to let everybody else know. So I'm driving one-handed. Most of my career, I was driving one-handed. So a lot of the things I'm telling them to do is like, even though I'm not doing it, like a lot of times I'm when I'm doing the pit maneuver, for instance, the students will even make comments like, how are you so calm and you're pitting somebody with one hand and you have a radio in this hand? Because I'm talking to the car and telling them, right, hey, keep driving, to I'm coaching them up while I'm pitting them and doing counter force off. And I'm like, I don't know. It's just, I guess it's, I've got so much time behind the wheel. It's just not much gets my blood up. But back to your question, I think I'm a big proponent of, and I didn't invent this, I just started doing it, but driving two-footed. Like, if even if it's an automatic, you should be working the brake with your left foot.
So you're holding. So this is like in off-road driving, they talk about like brake throttle modulation, right?
Brake throttle modulation. And in off-road, it's kind of like walking the vehicle, especially military folks. They're not just out there weekend warrior driving. They can't afford to get stuck. Because if they do, we go through a whole recovery process. But no, we tell them, hey, you should, it's paramount that you drive two-footed.
So when you're doing the two-foot driving, how do you mitigate the, like the shifting in the seat? Because you're not pushing with that left foot against the head wall. Like,
well, I always wear my seatbelt because a lot of times the students will, if they don't put it on, I'll find out pretty quickly, because in the first left turn, the car will go way off the course. And what happened is they threw themselves into the passenger seat. That's happened a lot. In fact, happened to me too, if I'm honest. Just forgot to put it on one day and showing off with some other instructors. So, you shouldn't get to the point where you're getting thrown like that is my point. And I think that two-footed braking really controls the balance of the vehicle. Like if you recall the serpentine, I'm literally going into the serpentine, and not to get too technical because some people are just kind of glaze over when I talk about that, but I'll literally input brake with my left foot and then start gassing it, feathering it to get through the serpentine, where a lot of times people will hit the brake and then the gas, and hit the brake and then the gas. And I'm like, two things that are happening, horribly inefficient. If I'm just looking at the timer alone, I know that you've lost 5 or 6 seconds in that obstacle alone. And you're unnecessarily, more importantly for military folks and law enforcement, is you're unnecessarily taxing the vehicle, the brakes, the rotors that you will count on later on. So it's just more efficiency sake. But I think to answer your question, if it's to keep the balance with my left foot, I've never experienced that. I've never experienced that being a problem. And I drive my personal, in fact, when I pulled into your parking lot, I promise you, I stopped the vehicle with my left foot. It's not just a tactical thing. It's like, I don't expect people to go to the grocery store driving two footed, but if you're going to do anything kinetic, you're going to be in pursuits, or pitting somebody or push ramming somebody, it's paramount that you do it, just because it's just a way to balance all that shifting that you're talking about, all that inertia in the vehicle. It really mitigates it. In fact, whenever I drive it, it looks a lot slower. It sounds a lot slower. But if you look at the timer, it's more efficient.
And when you're talking about shifting, it's not just the, like, you shifting in the vehicle, because I know a lot of the driving that you're teaching is about where's the weight of the vehicle distributed.
Right.
So it's balancing it now more evenly instead of front wheel, back wheel, front wheel, back wheel.
Yeah. Because to your point earlier, it's like, if I can keep the car doing as much as I can on what it's designed to do, which is to go straight and to be level. But like you said, if I'm turning and I'm braking, I'm losing efficiency in both. So I really am a big proponent of that one. But the biggest thing I would say, I don't even know if I have five, but the biggest thing I would say is, whatever platform you're going to drive, I need you to push it. If you're hitting cones, and I tell them, I'm like, you know, the cones are the metric. If you're going too fast, you're going to hit a cone, and we'll talk about that. But if I don't care how much tire noise you make, if you're not hitting cones and you're getting under the desired time, which is typically, and students, the first thing they always ask, especially special operations, because they're such competitive people, what's your time? And I will never tell them. That's the first thing they want to know is, what's your time? And I never tell them. And because I don't want them to, it's almost like somebody like Mikulet shooting against him. It's like, okay, if you expect to shoot like him, you think that he's just going fast. There's a lot more to it than that. So I don't even really talk about that. And I never even used to do a demo driving fast. I would just show them as a demo the course itself. And I'd pull up and I'm like, they would drive and I'm like, it would aggravate me. I'm like, why are you going so slow? This is an opportunity for you to, you know, have a little bit of fun and get aggressive. And then I realized, well, it's because I'm not showing them. They don't know what it sounds like. They don't know what it looks like. And they don't know what the car is capable of doing. So it's funny that the boss that I have now, Vrindavan, who we'll talk about, she actually came through and she was going through the course and she's super competitive and like a hard, she's just a hard driver. As far as this, I'm super motivated. I want to do better all the time. And so then I did it after she had driven the course for, I don't know, 6-7 laps. And she's going really slow. And I remember thinking, this is really slow. And she said, well, you drive it. Let me just switch seats. And so I drove it really fast. And she was like, well, I had no idea. You didn't tell me that. Like, you didn't show me that. So we pull back around. She's like, you have to give them some kind of reference. You have to show them that this is what, this is kind of the limit. This is, but I always thought it's kind of a jerk thing to do, to just drive really fast. But I found that through my own, just not wanting to be a kind of come off like a jerk, like I don't expect you to drive this fast, but the ones that are trying to do it and pushing it, especially guys that are going into some really bad places, I'm like, I'm doing them a disservice if I don't show them what it looks like. And I'm nothing special. I've just done it a lot.
Yeah.
But these soldiers, it's really fun to see them when they get in the car and they start going, because then I'll tell them my time. Because they'll time me. And they always tell me it's higher than the actual time is. And I sort of done it so much, I know what the time is sort of in my head when I'm driving. I know when it feels good. And I can always tell by about the third obstacle what my time's going to be, as long as I stay clean with obstacle strikes or cone strikes. But the student's always, it's like a minute 17. But I'll typically do it in like a minute or less. And a lot of people don't know what the course even consists of, so that means nothing to them. But the way the course is set up, it's just the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration course. It's the same course that most all law enforcement first responders go through. So it usually is about a minute-ish. And it's doable sub 50 seconds. And that's rare, but it's doable. But the last thing you want to do is tell a bunch of special operations guys before they've even driven one lap. Hey, you can do this in 50 seconds, because then it's just they're wide open.
Yeah.
And they're just pushing it, which I like, because I think that's good, because I would rather have somebody do that than have to tell somebody to speed up all the time. So I can sort of rein that in. I know that you're willing to do it. I know you're not afraid to do it. And some people are just afraid. I remember we had one student, we did the pit maneuver. And I remember she was standing there looking at me like really apprehensive. And I'm pretty good at describing it. And I'm also pretty good at saying, this is nothing hard. The pit maneuver is one of the easiest things you'll ever do in a car. This is easier, I would argue, than some of the other driving we did. So anyway, we demo it, and there's screeching tires and all this. And she looks at me. She says, oh, I'm not doing that. And I was like, why? And she's like, nah, well, and she had explained, well, she was in a pretty bad car wreck. So just like, you know, the incident I described earlier, obviously she hears those sounds. She smells that burning rubber, and it takes her right back to that car wreck, which I get that. So I'm like, well, just ride with me a couple times and just see how easy it is. I'll talk you through it. Next thing you know, like most students, she did the best of all of them. Once she got over that fear and she realized that cars are just way more durable, because like I was guilty of it when I was a kid, you know, on the movies, you know, cars would hit and they would explode and flip over. Right. And no, it's just the cars are way more durable than we give them credit for. So getting the student to get over their fear that the car is going to explode or it's going to flip over, we'll do the off-road recovery drill where we're forcing them off the pavement into some gravel, and they have to regain control of the car and get back onto the road in a controlled way and get between a couple of cones. Sounds hard. It's fun. Students love doing it, but that's happening out here right now.
Yeah. That was something when I took that formal driving in Virginia, we were told the scariest thing to do is to put too much steering input from the dirt to the pavement, because that's where you have no traction. Yeah. And we were told if the vehicle starts going sideways on the dirt, hit the gas. And we're like, whoa. They're like, you got to clear the sidewalls or else the car could flip. And then we were told, oh, you'd enter the Sky Dirt Club. And we're like, Sky Dirt? He goes, that's all you'll see. Sky Dirt, Sky Dirt. Sky.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God.
That's, you're right. Yeah. That's ominous. And that's a lot of our students. You know, it's scary, especially if you're not driving. It's because the students will sit in the car. And, you know, students will go off and they struggle with it. Now, when we demo it, it looks super easy, but it's really just a matter of, and you and I talked about it earlier, it's just look where you want the car to go. I'll literally tell them, it's just do less. Just do what the car is designed to do. Don't do anything more than that. Because typically 90% of those fatalities, especially single car fatalities, are that drill, off-road recovery, which we're going to do with some of your folks.
Yeah.
Which I think they love. And it's crucial, because it's probably going to, if it hasn't already, it's going to happen to them. Driving to and from work. It happened to me not too long ago, just out here on 15501. So that drill, but just getting students to understand through reps, if you just don't overcompensate in the steering wheel, if you just do less, just steer where you want to go. Look at where you want to go and drive that way. And the car, 99% of the time, you know, sometimes it's just going to happen. It's just what it is. Sometimes wrecks are unavoidable.
I got an embarrassing story. Mm-hmm. This has to have been back in 2014 mm-hmm. or 15, because I had my Toyota Tacoma at the time. Yeah. And I was leaving work, and I pull out of work. It's a left-hand turn. I go down the road, and then I'm turning down another road. So I'm taking a right-hand turn downhill, mm-hmm. and it's a sharp right-hand turn, and there was black ice. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, who am I, right? Like, I'm like, okay, you know, I've got this Toyota Tacoma. It's a turd, right? Toyota Racing, turd. So I got my turd, and I turn down this road. I hit black ice, and my vehicle starts fishtailing. I'm like, oh, great. Right. But I'm going slow enough where I'm like, I can recover. Mm-hmm. So I turn into it. Well, I go off the side mm-hmm. of the road a little bit, but I'm on someone's front yard, and I miss a driveway that's kind of like cut from, like, it's cut into a hill. So there's a drop off. Mm-hmm. I miss the drop off, but I drive over like this little shrub in the front yard. Mm-hmm. So me being the good citizen, I go and I knock on the door. I'm like, hey, just want to let you know there's black ice. I hit that plant. I'm going to replace that mm-hmm. plant. So luckily, like, no police got called, thank right. God, right? And here's my number, please contact mm-hmm. me. So I go and I replace the plant. Well, that lady who I replaced the plant for, she wasn't happy. I got her the same plant, she wanted a different plant. Oh, I had to replace that plant like five
yeah.
times.
Right? Oh yeah,
maybe I'm exaggerating, maybe it's like two times, but still, that whole thing happened where it was like, yeah. If I just kept turning into the fishtail, I could have done that the whole way down. Right. I was able to come off the brake. What I should have done in retrospect, and this is something that we talked about earlier, where it's like, man, I didn't see it coming.
Right.
I should have gotten my wheel straight on that mm-hmm. black ice instead of trying to turn and brake on the black mm-hmm. ice. And I could have just driven straight down, engine brake the whole
right.
way.
Right.
But again, hindsight's.
Yeah. But you learn from that.
Oh yeah.
Because even right now you're talking through exactly what you should have done. Yeah. So that's literally a lot of times for our students, they'll hit a cone or they'll, I'm like, but you learn from that.
Yes.
That's, I need to, in a safe environment, I'm going to make you make mistakes. Cause yeah. I'll learn more from that than I ever will anything good I did. Cause to this day, yeah. I will drive a course like, cause instructors, you know, there's always a little bit of behind the scenes instructor competition with us. And so, if I do a demo and I'll put pressure on other instructors, especially younger ones, I'm like, you know, whatever, you need to practice more. You know, before you can get to my yeah. level, you know, messing with them and all yeah, that. Yeah. But if I hit a cone in the demo, even if I touch a cone, I still remember that more than I remember any of the other good ones, you know, just like anybody that's competitive. But it's the same for the students. You know, I want to push them to failure, because if my goal is just to have them driving around cones all day slow and they didn't hit any cones, I didn't teach them anything. I really didn't. And so I want to push. That's one reason, like you were talking about feeling the vehicle. Especially like in law enforcement, if we were doing a pursuit, I'm not looking at anything. So the students will ask me, you know, I had one student ask me, and you know, I'm sure like every instructor out there, people say, oh, there are no dumb questions. There are. Let's be honest. There are some dumb questions. But this student said, hey, I keep hitting I hit one of the cones with my side view mirror every time. And he said, how do I fix that? And I was like, wait a minute, you're serious. I said, just a little bit more room. I said, but think about this, though. I said, you can live without a side view mirror. I mean, you'd like to keep it. But the questions they ask, and I'm just like, I don't know. I said, but what you should be paying attention to is not that side view mirror, is the next cone, is looking out beyond it. And so it's just funny to see some of the mistakes that you make. That I see the students do, but I'm like, but you learn from that. Now let's fix it. And if you can't diagnose how to fix it, they're just essentially students driving around cones all day and spending some, but if you can't, because of all my experience, especially investigating wrecks and having a chance to literally look at the math, this is why they wrecked, is because they were going too fast, and we can literally measure out the skid marks and tell you exactly to the tenth of a mile an hour how fast they were going. I mean, and so with all that insight, I think it's pretty valuable. And so the main thing is with the students is, going back to your question, thinking through this, is like two-footed driving. That's a big one, because it minimizes the shift that you were talking about, all the force and the sway of a vehicle, like that pendulum. I can minimize that through it, and it keeps the tires centered to the ground, and I can get a lot more acceleration quicker, which for a lot of our students, that's all they care about is the time. I'm like, but what you're really doing is like, I'll let you drive the course as however you want to drive it, as fast as you want to drive it, and I'll do the same. And then we'll pull them up and we'll look at the brakes afterwards. And mine are, I'm under your time. I'm not hitting cones and my brakes aren't smoking. And yours are. So, and once they figure out, okay, well, I've tried it my way. Now they'll listen to you. And then I'll get in the car with them and we'll do it and we'll push it.
You know what adds some juice or some spice to training a Griffin group, though, is the idea that you got parachutists.
Oh, yeah.
Going
the Golden Knights.
Golden Knights. Every 5 minutes are up in the air, right?
And all the JSOC at the other end. Yeah. It's constant. And it's funny because I talked to those guys. I said, hey, you know, I'm going to come over. And, you know, I was a law enforcement guy. So I never got a chance to do a lot of or any skydiving. And I'll talk to those guys. And they're like, yeah, but when we're in the air, we're watching you guys. We want to come do that. And all our guys are looking at them. And it's not uncommon for those guys to land on the track.
Really?
Oh yeah. I'll tell the students, I'll be like, hey, just if I cross my arms, that means just stop where you are, because it's not uncommon for somebody to kind of just get off target and land right. Especially when we're doing night driving.
Yeah.
Some of the special operations guys are doing night jumps. Luckily they know we're down there, but we're driving blacked out because a lot of guys are driving under nods. And so they can hear us, but they can't see us.
So between the parachutists, the full automatic gunfire, which
is constant, apparently.
It's constant. Yeah. Like you get into a zone. Mm-hmm. And I hate to say it, but like testosterone, adrenaline, mm-hmm. it works so against you when you're trying to stay calm. Like you put up like six or seven guys that are all super competitive. Mm-hmm. And then they start hearing that. They start seeing that. They start getting into the zone. Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, like
It almost scares me how desensitized I am. It's almost like if I heard, like I was in a town the other night and I heard a bunch of gunshots. And we were, you know, staying in a pretty nice hotel, but we were close enough and high enough up that I could hear sounded like almost like automatic gunfire. And I know that's not cops, but I didn't think anything of it. Like, I'm just afraid that if I'm ever in an active shooter, I've been around gunshots and sim rounds and all that stuff so long, I feel like I'm almost desensitized to it. But yeah, you're right. But it almost works to our advantage because I like all that stress because I can never replicate what they're going to go through in life or death situation. But as much stress as I can induce on them, the better. Now, a lot of people respond really well to it. And then a lot of people don't. And it's just funny who does and who doesn't, because I just don't think you're training unless I can induce stress on you. And for some students, just timer alone, that's stress enough, because these guys are so competitive. I don't care how many cones I hit. I just want to beat you. Yeah. What was your time? Because they'll always pull up. What was my time? I'm like, but you hit three cones. So you wrecked really fast. Mm-hmm. Now let's fix it and keep going fast.
So talking about stress, I mean, because like you're not just doing on pavement driving out there, you're doing Hilux, Toyota Hilux driving off there. And then we talked about eventually running a class where you have medical care while moving.
Right.
And that to me sounds absolutely insane. So I want to do it.
Yeah. It's some of the most fun training we've ever done. It's just watching, because I'm a huge proponent of medical. I think especially coming from law enforcement, we didn't get a lot of medical. And I remember, even in basic, I remember being super interested in it. And actually, one of the highest test scores I had in basic was that first responder training, we called it.
Yeah.
Which is just very, very basic stuff. But I remember thinking, I like this. But I never carried a tourniquet. I don't think I carried a tourniquet for the first 10 years of my career. Probably even, maybe even 15 of them.
I mean, they weren't
a big thing. But we didn't have even aid bags. I mean, we didn't have anything. We literally just, and I'm out there by myself. So if something happens, and I had no idea, an arterial bleed, you know, I had no idea of how fast that was. Because, you know, again, Hollywood, you know, the guy sitting there talking to you for 20 minutes, you know, I'm dying and I'm seeing the light and all that. But I had no idea. So only through sheer luck did I never need it. But to your point, we'll put students in scenarios where their heart rate's already up. We'll put role players with them, and well-trained role players that know how to react to certain wound patterns. And we'll put moulage on them. And the students know it. It's not like it's a surprise to them. They know it. But I'm like, we're going to see. They're like, this is just moulage. It's an actor. I'm like, okay. Then we put them in cars. After they've done like potentially like a brake contact or something, like a brake contact drill where they have to carry the student, put them in the car, and we don't let them practice it.
Yeah.
Now, some units will dry drill it, which if they do, great. But if they don't want to, it's like, okay, you should, but we're going to do it live. So we'll throw them in the car, and it never goes to plan, right? They say, well, I'm going to get on this side. You're going to get on this side. We'll put the patient in the middle so we can both work on them. I'm like, yeah, that sounds great. And I like that you have a plan. But it's never going to go that way, because typically what happens is they don't even wind up in the right car, much less the right position. And they'll sit, a lot of times they'll just throw the patient in the back. And then we'll start driving with them. And they all have IFACs. We'll drive with them, and the student's getting thrown around, and they've never put a tourniquet on in a moving vehicle. And I'll drive I'm driving just to keep it safe, but I'll drive as fast as you let me. And I'm driving like we just got out of a shooting. Mm-hmm. So I'm driving as fast as I can. And obviously in the back of the car, the students are getting thrown around and they're trying to work medical. All they have to do is tell me to slow down. Because I'll even tell them if we're out of contact, you know, tell me.
Yeah.
So I'm driving and we'll drive through an obstacle course. So obviously the students in the back are getting, they're trying to work this medical. They're trying to get them trauma naked by getting all their clothes off to see where all the wounds are. They just can't do it. And it's a yard sale in the IFAC because, you know, they'll open it and things just go flying everywhere. And then they start screaming at each other. And then they start getting angry at each other. And meanwhile, I'm just driving. I'm driving. I'm still throwing them around. And they never, I won't say never, but a lot of times they won't just think to take a breath and tell me, hey, I'm about to do a needle D. Slow down or stop. We're not getting shot at. Take a second. Or even something as small as turning the heat on. Because, you know, hypothermia, big deal with blood loss. But they don't think about it. And I'm like, but you'll just see the stress and that sort of thing. And they learn a lot from it. We'll videotape it. And I'll, like, don't take my word for it. This is what I saw. But I want you to watch the video. As, you know, and they laugh about it and that sort of thing. But they know the importance of it. But they just don't get a chance to do that much. So that's one thing that I think is important. But that is do the medical, get a good baseline of your skills, but then add stress and then a moving vehicle on top of that. Yeah, so it's really fun.
I think that's going to be one of the most exciting classes that we're going to do in 2024. Mm-hmm. And we just got to find time to fit it in with what you're doing now, which what you're doing now is pretty damn exciting. So can you kind of talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I loved working at Griffith Group, still do part time, because I love teaching. But then after the Uvalde school shooting, in fact, the morning after that, I called the local sheriff's department, Scotland County, and I talked to the captain there. And I said, what are you doing this morning? He said, we're going to go to the schools and touch base with all that, you know, principals and that sort of thing. I said, hey, do you mind if I go with you? He said, yeah, I'd love to go with us. So we went to a school there in the community, and I just saw that this is such an easy target. Like, mm-hmm. this is, and it's through no fault of the school system or anything. They don't know what they don't know. You know, trust me, they want to fix it. A lot of times they just don't either have the funds or the knowledge on how to fix it. Mm-hmm. So they need some guidance. So I literally walked right in the front door and the principal happened to be the first person I saw and talked to her for at least an hour and a half. And she said that she'd like to do something. So I went straight from that office to the school superintendent, sat in her office, who I happened to have met several weeks before the Chamber of Commerce had put on something for local professionals. So she actually came out and did some training with us at Griffin, just looking at the place. So I actually knew her, which is, you know, coincidentally. So I went to her office, and to her credit, without an appointment or anything, I told her I was here. Her assistant went by there and told her. She said, yeah, she'd love to see you. So we went by there and we talked for another hour and a half about what we could do and how Griffin would love to help and in any way we could. So we started doing that. So I called a former student that I knew and really respect her and her opinion. I knew she was willing and able to help. So I called her and I said, hey, would you be willing to do anything to help me? And she's amazing. But she said, yeah, absolutely. She said, I'll tell you what, I think we talked briefly and she said, let me call you back later. So she called me back later and she said, do you mind if I loop my sister in the call?
Yeah.
And I knew who her sister was. I knew her sister was former law enforcement. But I didn't know anything else. I said, of course, I'm willing to take all the help I can get. So she gets on the phone, and it's Vrindavan Bellard, and everybody just calls her V, because as soon as she said her name, I was like, I'm never going to be able to say that right. She said, just call her V. Everybody calls her V. So she gets on the phone, and of course, I slay her name. I was like, Vrindavan or something. Anyway, and she's used to that. Anyway, we started talking, and we started talking about that, and she had some really good ideas and was willing to help, and she had done some assessments already, and she worked with the Marshall Service, and she worked with the Attorney General and done some of their stuff that I'm sure I'm not describing right, but I know she had done some protection work too, in addition to all the fugitive apprehension work she had done in New York and D.C. So she was pretty well, I mean, she's knowledgeable, and I'm like, man, I could use your help. And to her credit, we started talking on the phone about all the gaps that we see in law enforcement. And this, because, you know, I mean, I know people are beating up those cops in Uvalde. I wasn't there, number one. I know how chaotic situations can be like that. I mean, were there things that they could have done better? I mean, yeah, I think I can say that coming from law enforcement. You know, when people outside of law enforcement or military start criticizing law enforcement or military, it's hard to take. But if you just look at that, and I've seen the training that law enforcement got with CQB type work or room clearing work, and I've just seen a lot of gaps in that. But anyway, so I'm not beating them up, but obviously there's a problem, and we got to figure out what it is. So on the telephone, we started working on, well, what can we do? We can just do something for Scotland County. Number one, they're asking, and we're able to do it. So she came out, and Sheffield Ford, owner of the company, Griffin Group, he's like, yeah, absolutely. Let's help you. Let's have a big meeting here at Griffin. Mm-hmm. So, you know, logistically, it's a nightmare to just get all these different entities to show up, all the stakeholders from EMS to the communications center, where the call's going to come in first. To all the first responders, state, local, federal, and then the school system and that sort of thing. So, and some politicians came. So she helped me organize that, and to her credit, flew out and landed and helped me to set all that up. So we did that. We did some stuff for the school system, and we just were able to listen to officers talk and being honest, like, hey, we want to do it. We just don't have the money. Mm-hmm. Like, we just don't have the money to train. And you know, even the training that they do get, you know, there's some bad, you know, and I know you guys have great instructors who I've in fact raved about. Like Rick Lofton is one of my favorite people. Yeah, I love amazing. Rick. Right. So, and he is squared away on the range. And so, but unfortunately people like Rick are not in the law enforcement training space. It's some bad training. I'll just be honest. There's some really bad training. I was actually able to witness or just observe some training because Griffin Group basically loaned a bunch of SIM pistols and donated the ammunition to the local law enforcement agency that was going to go through some CQB training or room clearing. And I remember watching it. I was biting my lip to the point where I was bleeding almost. I'm like, this is going to get these guys killed. Like, I remember one scenario where they literally walked all the officers into a room and they had paper targets up and showed them. There's a bad guy here. There's a bad guy in that corner. There's a bad guy over here. So these officers walk in there and they look at everything. And he says, all right, now go out, load up, and we're going to do this. And so they walked in there and they had not changed them. You know, I'm thinking, oh, they're just showing us that, knowing that we're probably going to shoot at it. But they didn't change it. So these cops came in and they shot. They had seen it. The heart rate never got up. I saw one officer literally go into a room at slide lock. Like, he had shot from outside into the room, which I'm not, you know, but, and I fault the instructor for this, but the officer, he's amped up, right? And I see his pistol go to slide lock and he goes in the room, right? And so all the training was stopped. I'm thinking, okay, well, at least he saw that and he's going to address that. And he calls them all out in the hallway and he's barking at them. And he's like, I heard you say, hey, buddy, come in here. And he's like, yeah, I did. He said, I want you guys to call each other operators. You're not saying you do not identify each other under any other term but operator. And I'm like, you're barking at them about calling each other operator. Well, let's be honest. They're not. That's a different thing. But you didn't see the slide lock. And you didn't see that the target has got one hole in it and the wall has got six in it. And they just don't get a chance to do it. And I don't fault the officer for that. They're trying. They're there. Their supervisor, their sheriff, their chief sent them. But the level of training that they're getting, it scared me.
Yeah,
it really scared me. So she and I, we talked about it. And we started talking to all these different agencies, and we see a lot of gaps in the training. They want to train, they just aren't given good instructors. And so companies like Fieldcraft and Griffin Group and the company that we're making, I think they're going to be able to at least afford a chance to get some credible, good training.
You know, when we mentioned driving and how the powers that be didn't want those guys to get injured and whatnot. Right. There's a very fine line with training between injury and training. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, whenever we put people in a blower suit,
yeah,
and then there are role players that are not in the blower suit, when the person walks in, it's like, oh, there's the guy in the red suit or the blue suit. Right. Oh, we can beat him up.
Right.
Well, how do you get rid of that? You say, well, your role player has to be tough enough to take the shot. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone is going to wear headgear.
Right.
Or no one's going to wear headgear, and we're not going to use Sims pistols or airsoft. We're going to use CERT pistols, you know, like, but there's definitely a fine line. And I could see that happening in so many different training spaces. Mm-hmm. But the good thing is that you are smart enough to recognize that, your partner is smart enough to recognize that, and you're going to bring a next level of training, which is clearly, clearly needed.
Yeah. She's probably one of the most amazing people I've ever met, if not the. So her ideas that she's got and just her vision. And, you know, we talked about it. We're like, she's like, look, I don't, you know, when we talk about people that we want to bring in, they're people we want to work with, and which is why I'm here. I mean, you know, Fieldcraft has some great courses and some great people working there. I've only met Mike Glover once. I think maybe, once he had come over to Griffin Group when you guys did some things there. But I like what Fieldcraft's doing. I love what they're doing. So you're a company that we want to work with, because her main thing was, is like, you have to be a good human first. Mm-hmm. If you're not that, it doesn't matter what you shoot, what you call, how you drive. It's like, if you're not a good human, and I never even thought about that. I'm like, wow, you know, it's, yeah, that's, I can work from that. But like the vetting process, like law enforcement, let's be honest, I can say it, coming from that community, there's a lot of cops getting through that shouldn't, that are getting on the road and making decisions. Like George Floyd, that was murder. No way around that. That was just a lack of training, and that was murder. I don't know that officer. I don't even remember his name. I could see his face, and I fault the officer that stood there and watched him too. You're obligated to intervene in that. But just being a good person, but then how do you do it? It's like, where are we missing the vetting process? And how are these officers getting through? And they haven't been tested under stress. So we do a lot of training at Griffin that's like close proximity, unanticipated gunfights. And, you know, I think it was third group that came out and went through the training. And they have a sports psychologist with them that monitors the heart rate and all that. So, and those guys are always, they do a lot of stress-induced or saturated training. But I remember I had a cop in there one time, and a guy just walked through the room. And I told the role player, I said, don't do anything. I just walk through the room. I had sent a female in first. A female goes in, and I said, do the exact same thing she did. Go in the room and don't shoot or anything. Just walk through the room. Hey, how are you? And you got the helmet on, but nothing else. We don't have the blower suits. We just have headgear, neck gear, and that's it. You know, I don't know how many sim round scars I have. But so that officer's heart rate went through the roof based on the second person that went through, based on some, you know, preconceived notions about this person's, whether it be race or what he's wearing. If we don't identify that, like, we're doing a disservice to the community and that officer to put him out in the world. I don't think I ever had any force on force training. I know I didn't in the academy at all. It was all notional. Like, you know, when they put you in scenarios, say, all right, you got shot, take a knee, you're out of it. I remember thinking, I don't think I would have gotten shot there. But there's no doubt if a sim round hits you, that pain consequence of making a bad decision, right? But whether it's that or how do we vet them to start with? Like, what kind of people are we looking for? And the challenge is, who wants to be a cop anymore? you know, these guys that are saying, I have 8 years left, I'm counting the days. And these guys that I have a lot of military folks, students ask me on graduation day, hey, I'd love to be a cop. And, you know, I hate to say it. It's like sometimes I'm like, well, I want to talk you out of it.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's a shame. And I don't want to do that because I feel like it's I'm obligated to get good officers out there. But I don't have any sympathy. Nobody hates a bad cop worse than a good one.
So you think about it now. How many cops are just getting out of the academy that know that the job is not what it used to be?
Yeah.
God bless those people.
I talked to one in Chicago yesterday. No, two or three days ago. I talked to a young officer. I saw him come into where we were. And he's obviously brand new out of the academy. Yeah. I could just see the just look on this kid's face that he's just like he brand new. So I walked over, introduced myself to him. Didn't tell him who I was or what I was doing, that I was a cop. I just started talking to him. I said, how long have you been on? He said, man, it's my first year. I'm like, what made you? Like, and he's in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Like, that's, you know, it's pretty brutal.
Yeah.
And right now, Chicago is dangerous. I think the cops are doing the best they can. It's not their fault. But anyway, I asked him. He said, man, I just always wanted to do it. It's a calling, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And it's like military. It's like anything. If you're really wanting to do it, it's a calling. Like I said earlier, I didn't even know what I made money-wise the first year. I didn't care. I loved it. But how do we find officers like that? And the ones that were sure, I was on interview boards, and when guys would say things like, well, you know, what kind of vacation do we get? What's 401k plan like? I'm like, you might be in the wrong place. Like,
right.
Which is not the right attitude. You know, I get it now, but back then I was a little salty. I'm like, if you ain't in this to be a cop, if this is not a calling for you, you should probably go work somewhere else. This is just, I just don't think this is a good fit for you. But the vetting process, we've identified that how do we even do that? And we don't know. We're literally working on it. We got some good ideas and she's got some great ideas. And we've talked to all these federal, state, local law enforcement agencies. And what do you feel like the gaps are? And, you know, there's obviously officers don't want to talk about things that they see that they feel are wrong because they feel like, well, that's going to list me as a snitch or whatever. And mm-hmm. I've been there. I've been in those situations and they're rough. It's a moral thing. I think the big challenge is obviously all the skills, like the shooting skills, the medical skills and all that. But first off, how do we find the right people to even get in this career? Were you bullied as a kid? And I've seen that. I've seen officers that were pushed around when they were a kid and they get a badge and they get a gun, and then they take it out on the community. And that makes it hard for the good cops, right? That George Floyd cop, he made it so hard for all the good cops. And people, I think they understand. It's like nobody hates that kind of stuff more than a good cop.
Because
now, you know, you've made my job so much harder. I definitely ain't in this for the money. This is a calling. And when the morale gets so bad that you across the country, I'll ask them, how many vacancies do you have? I know Chicago, the number he told me was thousands. It might have been 1,000. Yeah. Or no, it couldn't have been that high, but it was definitely super high. And he's like, we just can't get anybody. Nobody wants to do it.
And the interesting thing is it's not just at the patrol level. Right. It's the higher ups. It's the sergeants, the lieutenants, the captains. Like, mm-hmm. they're all vacating.
Yeah.
You know?
100%. And it's like they just – it's a mass exodus. So almost – I think it was North Carolina that decided they were going to change the retiring age from 30 to 25. Mm-hmm. Then they realized if we do that, all those senior guys are going to get out, mass exodus. Yep. And so I think they staggered it like 27 and then 26, 25, because everybody wanted to leave. And that's a shame because the good officers that are out there with the good ones, and I mean the good ones, not the ones that are just retired on duty, that are just hanging out in the office. Everybody's got them. But officers with experience, they should stay and mentor and guide these officers. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of that. I think I had out of my whole career one or two officers that really took the time to mentor me. The rest of them were just, you know, felt like, hey, this is a competition. I'm going to arrest more people than you. And I fell for that. And I started, I'm just going to go out here and charge people. And then I realized, well, wait a minute, these are people. These are people that live in the community. Yeah, they're criminals. You know, they're doing criminal things, but they're not bad people necessarily. And that's
right. It's
something I learned. I worked some really bad neighborhoods. And the thing I'm most proud of is that I had the reputation for being fair. And if I didn't learn anything else in law enforcement, through in, and it carries into my life now, is there's two sides to every story. And listen, and don't be so extreme one way or the other. Because I, you know, I've arrested people, and I would even say they're friends now, and I mean some, they were slinging dope, and you know, but it was almost, you remember that old cartoon? I always use this. Remember the old cartoon, the Bugs Bunny, where the I think it was a sheepdog and the wolf would come in, and they would clock in. And they, morning, Sam.
Yeah, I know.
Morning, Jim. And they'd go in, and they would be at each other's throat for 8 hours, and they'd clock out. See you tomorrow, Sam. And that's really how it felt. It's like, you're doing your thing, I'm doing my thing, but that doesn't mean I have to be a bad human. That doesn't mean I'm going to mistreat you. Because at the end of the day, you're human. And be honest with you, like because I work so much in those areas, it's like they don't have a lot of choice. I know people, that's going to be controversial. Oh, they always have a choice. Well, you've never lived their lives. You never lived in their environment where they weren't given opportunities. So it's almost like, I get it. I don't condone it. I don't agree with it, but I understand it. And so it makes it easier to be a cop when you can come at it from like, I get it. It's not personal. Like if you ran from me, I mean, I would have ran from the cops. Don't fight me. Don't swing on me. Don't try to shoot me or anything like that. But I don't blame you for running. I never hold that against you, but I would see it. I would see officers take it personal. And I would always grab that guy and say, look, he's running from you. He's running from the uniform. He's not running from you. He didn't even know you. He's running from the jail.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't take it personal and understand that it's not personal, that's the hardest thing for a lot of cops. And it was hard for me until, you know, I stood over people that I had arrested, and we weren't like hanging out and having barbecues together, but I would see them all the time, you know, and there's a way to work the communities. I would give them money sometimes because I know what I'm doing is I'm building credit with them. I remember one of the most proud moments I had for what kind of cop I was somebody had shot somebody. It was an incident we responded to. It was at a club. And it's funny enough, the victim, I had arrested him like a week before that for like DWI. He was a giant man. I mean, he had just come out of prison. And I'm thinking, I was terrified that this guy's going to fight me. But anyway, talked to him, took him in, arrested him. Fast forward to like a week later, we respond to a call and he got shot in the temple, right in the side of the head. And I got there pretty fast because we were in the area already. And I'm standing over him. He's taking his last breath. I'm the last thing he sees on earth. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking to him. I'm saying his name, but he's taking that death rattle. You know, he's breathing. And I'm just trying to say, get him to tell me a victim. I mean, tell me the shooter, because I know he's not going to make it. And he couldn't. He didn't say. And everybody else was telling us. And that kid had essentially what happened. They got into a little scuffle inside. And the kid says, meet me outside. I'll fight you. That guy goes out ahead of time. As the victim comes out, he ambushes him, shoots him right in the side of the head. The guy never even saw it coming. Well, damn. The guy, obviously, he fled and he goes out of state. And a couple of days later, he had called the communication center and said, if David Blaylock's working, I will turn myself in. I will not turn myself into anyone else. And that's, you know, a testament. And I'd arrested this kid a lot. And it's just a testament to, you know, be a good human. You know, and don't take it personal, and treat them with respect. You don't have to do anything to help them, but also don't go out of your way to screw people over, and don't stack charges on them just because you don't like them and that sort of thing. And it will literally make your career much easier. I mean, things like that will happen where it's like, we solved a murder case. I didn't do it. I mean, I was a basic police officer, but because I'd had a good reputation in the community and they knew I was fair, we were able to solve a murder. For that, and he came in, turned himself in,
and I think that's that might be where we leave this. Is that, you know, for all the negative press that you hear about with the cops, there's so much press that you never hear about the reasoning behind someone turning themselves in. Mm-hmm. Like the media is not there to cover that. They don't. They never will.
Yeah.
Man, there's so much more we could talk about, and obviously, I want to follow up with your partner. Where can people reach out to you or follow you or get in touch with you? Where can they train with you?
Yeah.
You know, cause we got, this is a,
yeah, I know.
There's so much more.
I know. We could talk forever. And, but before I get into that, to your point, there's so many cops out there doing good every day. It's, that it's not going to be in the paper. It's there's a cop within probably a couple of miles of us right now changing somebody's tire, or they're carrying a woman away from an abusive husband right now. Mm-hmm. So there's just, I would say, but that doesn't make the press, right? That's not an interesting story when a cop's doing what, you know, they're supposed to do, which is help the community. So I don't ever want it to sound like I'm bashing them, because it's just like, but I'm critical of them because I love them and I want them to do the right thing. So, but to your point, to your question about the training. So the company is called Toa Group. And so Toa is Samoan for warrior. And you can get in touch with us through an email right now. We're literally in the such early stages of building startup. This. Yeah. So the website is currently under construction right now. But you can get us on an email at v@toagroup.us. And that's v@toagroup.us. And Toa, again, is Samoan for warrior. And I will completely say this wrong, but basically the phrase or our slogan is Samoan, and I will tell you what it is in my very best Southern accent. But it's Epui Pui Ma Tautua Lenu'u, and that basically means to protect and serve the village. And it's Samoan and Polynesian. So I'm sure, in fact, I had a Samoan student recently and I tried to practice some Samoan on him. He said, wow, you sound like a guy that's from North Carolina trying to speak it. So I told her whenever I said, I'm going to practice this as much as I can before. But that's our slogan. And that's, you know, her mindset. And this is why I'm completely committed to helping her, because I believe that her vision is exactly like mine, but better. Much like when I left law enforcement and started joining Griffin Group to do training, it's like, but then I saw this. I'm like, well, now I can even reach it even on a broader scale and specifically to law enforcement, which is where my heart is. Because even though I'm not active, I'm still a cop.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm going to be a cop till I die. And so my family, I can't not be. So we're doing that. And there's just a lot. I would love for her to come in and speak to you. She can speak into the specifics of it, but mm-hmm. there are some really interesting and some exciting things coming, and we'd love to in any way help Fieldcraft and big fan of you guys and what you're doing. Yeah.
Well, David, thank you for everything that you've done. Mm-hmm. You continue to do with us and I wish you all the best in the future. And for all the law enforcement out there, you know, obviously this podcast is dedicated to, you know, the two officers who were murdered, and to the mm-hmm. honor of the officer who saved everyone else. But this is also for all you guys. Continue doing what you're doing and stay strong out there. We appreciate you. Guys, thank you so much for listening to the Fieldcraft for All podcast. Until next time.